to search for matches with known organisms, directed the output to the printer, and waited. Finally, the pages began scrolling out. At the top of the first sheet, the computer had printed, Species, unknown, 10% randomized genetic matches with known species. Genus, unknown, family, unknown, order, unknown, class, unknown, phylum, unknown, kingdom, unknown. Cripes, Margot, what did you put in here? I don't even know if this is an animal or plant. And you won't believe how much CPU time it took to figure that out. Margot had to smile. So this was how Kawakita's sophisticated experiment in artificial intelligence communicated with the outside world. And the results were ridiculous. Kingdom unknown? The damn program couldn't even tell if it were a plant or animal. Margot suddenly felt she knew why Kawakita had been reluctant to show her the program in the first place. Why it took a call from Frock to get things in motion. Once you strayed out of its known provinces, the program grew flaky. She scanned the printout. The computer had identified very few genes from the specimen. There were the usual ones common to almost all life, a few respiration cycle proteins, cytochrome Z, various other universal genes, and there were also some genes linked to cellulose, chlorophylls, and sugars, which Margot knew were specific plant genes. At the waiting prompt, she typed, How come you don't even know if it is an animal or plant? I see lots of plant genes in here. There was a pause. Didn't you notice the animal genes in there, too? Run the data through GenLab. Good point, thought Margot. She dialed up GenLab on the modem, and soon the familiar blue logo popped up on the screen. She uploaded the DNA data from the fibers and ran it against their botanical subbank. Same results, almost nothing. A few matches with common sugars and chlorophylls. On an impulse, she ran the DNA data through the entire databank. There was a long pause, and then a flood of information filled the screen. Margot quickly hit a series of keys, instructing the terminal to capture the data. There were numerous matches with a variety of genes she had never heard of. Logging off GenLab, she fed the data she'd captured into Kawakita's program, instructing it to tell her what proteins the genes coded for. A complicated list of the specific proteins created by each gene started to scroll down the screen. Glycotetraglycine collagenoid. Weinstein's thyrotropic hormone 2,6-adenosine, gram positive. 1,2,3-oxytocin, 4-monoxytocin suppressin hormone, 2,4-diglyceride diethylglobulin ring alanine, gamma globulin A, XY, left positive, hypothalamic corticotropic hormone, left negative, 1,1,1-sulfagen, 2,3-murine, connective carotenoid, 3,4-involution, hexagonal amyloid reovirus protein coat. Reverse transcriptase enzyme. The list went on and on. A lot of these seemed to be hormones, she thought, but what kind of hormones? She located a copy of Encyclopedia of Biochemistry that was busily gathering dust on a shelf, dragged it down, and looked up glycotetraglycine collagenoid. A protein common to most vertebrate life. It is the protein that bonds muscle tissue to cartilage. She flipped through to Weinstein's thyrotropic hormone, a thalamoid hormone present in mammals that elevates release of the neurotransmitter epinephrine from the thyroid gland. It plays a role in the well-known fight-or-flight syndrome by speeding up the heart, elevating body temperature, and possibly increasing mental alertness. A terrible thought began to form inside her head. She looked up the next, 1,2,3-oxytocin, 4-monoxytocin suppressin hormone. A hormone secreted by the human hypothalamus gland. Its function is not clearly understood. Recent studies have shown that it might regulate levels of testosterone in the bloodstream during periods of high stress. Bouchard, 1992, Dennison, 1991. Margot sat back with a start, the book dropping to the floor with a hollow thud. As she picked up the phone, she glanced at the clock. It was 3:30. 38. When the Buick's driver had pulled away, Pendergast mounted the steps to a museum side entrance, juggling two long cardboard tubes beneath one arm as he showed his identification to the waiting security guard. At the temporary command post, he shut the door to his office and extracted several yellowed blueprints from the tubes, which he spread across his desk. For the next hour, he remained nearly motionless, head resting on tented hands, studying. Occasionally, he jotted a few words in a notebook or referred to typewritten sheets that lay on one corner of the desk. Suddenly, he stood up. He took a final look at the curling blueprints and slowly ran his finger from one point to another, pursing his lips. Then he gathered up most of the sheets, returned them carefully to the cardboard tubes, and stowed them in his coat closet. The rest he folded carefully and placed in a two-handled cloth bag that lay open on his desk. Opening a drawer, he removed a double-action Colt 45 Anaconda, narrow and long and evil-looking. The weapon fit snugly into the holster under his left arm. A handful of ammunition went into his pocket. From the drawer, he also removed a large, bulky yellow object, which he placed in the cloth bag. Then, smoothing his black suit and straightening his tie, he slipped his notebook into the breast pocket of his jacket, picked up the cloth bag, and left his office. New York City had a short memory for violence, and in the vast public spaces of the museum, streams of visitors could be seen once again. Groups of children crowded around exhibits, pressing noses against the glass, pointing and laughing. Parents hovered nearby, maps and cameras in hand. Tour guides walked along, reciting litanies. Guards stood warily in doorways. Through it all, Pendergast glided unnoticed. He walked slowly into the Hall of the Heavens. Potted palms lined two sides of the enormous room, and a small army of workers made last-minute preparations. The speaking platform on the podium was being sound-checked by two technicians, and imitation native fetishes were being placed on 100 white linen tablecloths. A hum of activity floated up past the Corinthian columns into the vast circular dome. Pendergast checked his watch. 4 o'clock, precisely. All the agents would be at Coffey's briefing. He walked briskly across the hall toward the sealed entrance of the Superstition exhibition. A few brief words were exchanged, and a uniformed officer on duty unlocked the door. Several minutes later, Pendergast emerged from the exhibition. He stood for a moment thinking. Then he walked back across the hall and out into the corridors beyond. Pendergast moved into the quieter backwaters of the museum, out of the public spaces. Now he was in the storage areas and laboratories where no tourist was permitted. The high ceilings and vast decorative galleries gave way to drab, cinder-block corridors lined with cabinets. Steam pipes rumbled and hissed overhead. Pendergast stopped once at the top of a metal staircase to look around for a moment, consult his notebook, and load his weapon. Then he moved downward into the narrow labyrinths of the museum's dark heart. 39. The door to the lab banged open, then eased back slowly. Margot looked up to see Frock backing himself inside, his wheelchair creaking. She quickly stood up and helped him wheel over to the computer terminal. She noticed he was already dressed in his tuxedo. Probably put it on before he came to work, she thought. The usual Gucci handkerchief protruded from his breast pocket.
I can't understand why they put these labs in such out-of-the-way places, he grumbled. Now, what's the great mystery, Margot? And why did I have to come down to hear it? Tonight's foolishness is getting underway shortly, and my presence will be required on the dais. It's a hollow honor, of course. It's only due to my best-selling status. Ian Cuthbert made that abundantly clear in my office this morning.
His voice sounded bitter, resigned. Quickly, she explained how she had analyzed the fibers from the packing crate. She showed him the incised disc with its harvest scene. She described the discovery and contents of Whittlesey's journal and letter, and the talk with Jorgensen. And she mentioned how the hysterical old woman described in Whittlesey's journal could not have been referring to the figurine when she warned the scientist about Mbun. Frock listened, gently turning the stone disc over in his hands.
It's an interesting story,
he said.
But why the urgency? Chances are your sample just got contaminated, and for all we know, that old woman was insane, or Whittlesey's recollections just got a bit scrambled.
That's what I thought originally, but look at this, Margot said, handing Frock the printout. He scanned it quickly.
Curious, he said. But I don't think that this...
His voice trailed off as his pudgy fingers ran down the columns of proteins.
Margot, he said, looking up. I was far too hasty. It is contamination of sorts, but not from a human being.
What do you mean? Margot asked.
See this hexagonal amyloid reovirus protein? This is the protein from the shell of a virus that infects animals and plants. Look at how much of it there is in here. And you have reverse transcriptase, an enzyme almost always found in association with viruses.
I'm not sure I understand. Frock turned to her impatiently.
What you have here is a plant heavily infected with a virus. Your DNA sequencer was mixing them up, coding for both. Many plants carry viruses like this, a bit of DNA or RNA in a protein coat. They infect the plant, take over some of its cells, then they insert their genetic material into the plant's genes. The plant genes start producing more viruses instead of what they're supposed to produce. The oak gall virus makes those brown balls you see on oak leaves, but otherwise it's harmless. Burls on maple and pine trees are also caused by viruses. They're just as common in plants as they are in animals.
I know, Dr. Frock, but...
There is something in here I don't understand, he said, laying down the printout. A virus normally codes for other viruses. Why would a virus code for all these human and animal proteins? Look at all these. Most of them are hormones. What good are human hormones in a plant?
That's what I wanted to tell you, Margot said. I looked up some of the hormones. A lot of them seem to be from the human hypothalamus gland. Frock's head jerked as if he had been slapped.
Hypothalamus.
His eyes were suddenly alive. That's right.
And the creature that's loose in this museum is eating the hypothalamus of its victims. So it must need these hormones. Perhaps it's even addicted to these hormones, Frock blurted. Think. There are only two sources. The plants, which, thanks to this unique virus, are probably saturated with the hormones, and the human hypothalamus. When the creature can't get the fibers, it eats the brain.
Jesus, how awful, Margot breathed.
This is stunning. It explains exactly what's behind these terrible murders. With this, we can now put the pieces together. We have a creature loose in the museum, killing people, opening the calivaria, removing the brain, and eating the thalamoid region where the hormones are most concentrated.
He continued to look at her, his hands trembling slightly.
Cuthbert told us that he'd hunted up the crates in order to retrieve the Mbuon figurine, only to find one of the crates broken open and the fibers scattered about. In fact, now that I think of it, one of the larger crates was nearly empty of fibers. So this creature must have been eating the fibers for some time. Maxwell obviously used the same fibers to pack his crates. The creature may not need to eat much. The hormonal concentration in the plants must be very high, but it obviously needs to eat regularly.
Frock leaned back in the wheelchair.
10 days ago, the crates were moved into the secure area, and then 3 days later the two boys are killed. 2 more days, and a guard is killed. What has happened? Simple. The beast cannot get to the fibers anymore, so it kills a human being and eats its hypothalamus, thus satisfying its craving. But the hypothalamus only secretes minute amounts of these hormones, making it a poor substitute for this fiber. Based on the concentrations described in this printout, I'd hazard a guess that it would require 50 human brains to equal the concentration found in 1 ounce of these plants.
Dr. Frock, Margot said, I think the Kothoga were growing this plant. Whittlesey collected some specimens in his plant press, and the picture on this incised disc is of a plant being harvested. I'm sure these fibers are just the pounded stems from the lily pad in Whittlesey's press. the plant depicted on this disc. And now we know. These fibers are what the woman was referring to when she screamed, "Mbun, Mbun, son of the devil." That's the name of this plant. She quickly brought the strange plant out of the press. It was dark brown and shriveled, with a web of black veins. The leaf was thick and leathery, and the black stem as hard as a dried root. Gingerly, Margot brought her nose close to it. It smelled musky. Frock looked at it with a mixture of fear and fascination.
"Margot, that's brilliant," he said. "The Kathoga must have built a whole ceremonial facade around this plant, its harvest in preparation, no doubt to appease the creature. And no doubt that very beast is depicted in the figurine. But how did it get here? Why did it come?"
"I think I can guess," Margot said, her thoughts racing. "Yesterday, the friend who helped me search the crates told me he read of a similar series of murders in New Orleans several years ago. They'd occurred on a freighter coming in from Belém. My friend located the shipping records of the museum crates, and he found that the crates were on board that ship."
"So the creature was following the crates," said Frock.
"And that's why the FBI man Pendergast came up from Louisiana," Margot replied. Frock turned, his eyes burning.
"Dear God, we've lured some terrible beast into a museum in the heart of New York City. It's the Callisto effect with a vengeance. A savage predator bent on our destruction this time. Let's pray there's only one."
"But just what kind of creature could it be?" asked Margot.
"I don't know," Frock answered. "Something that lived up on the Tapui, eating these plants. A bizarre species, perhaps surviving since the time of the dinosaurs in tiny numbers. Or perhaps the product of a freak turn of evolution. The Tapui, you see, is a highly fragile ecosystem, a biological island of unusual species surrounded by rainforest. In such places, animals and plants can develop strange parallels, strange dependencies on each other. A shared DNA pool, think of it. And then..."
Frock was silent.
"Then," he said loudly, slapping his hand on the arm of the wheelchair, "then they discover gold and platinum on that Tapui. Isn't that what Jorgensen told you? Shortly after the expedition fell apart, they fired the Tapui, built a road, brought in heavy mining equipment. They destroyed the entire ecosystem of that Tapui, and the Kathoga tribe with it. They polluted the rivers and swamps with mercury and cyanide."
Margot nodded vigorously. "The fires burned for weeks out of control, and the plant that sustained this creature became extinct."
"So the creature started on a journey to follow these crates and the food it so desperately craved."
Frock fell into silence, his head settling on his chest. "Dr. Frock," Margot finally said quietly, "how did the creature know the crates had gone to Belém?" Frock looked at her and blinked.
"I don't know," he finally said. "That's strange, isn't it?"
Suddenly, Frock was gripping the sides of the wheelchair, rising up in his excitement.
"Margot," he said, "we can find out exactly what this creature is. We have the means right here. The extrapolator. We've got the creature's DNA. We'll feed it into the program and get a description."
Margot blinked. "You mean the claw?"
"Exactly."
He wheeled around to the lab's workstation, and his fingers began moving over the keys.
"I had the printout Pendergast left us scanned into the computer," he said. "I'll load its data into Gregory's program right now. Help me set things up, will you?"
Margot took Frock's place at the keyboard. In a moment, another message flashed. "Estimated time to completion, 55.30 minutes. Hey, Margot, this looks like a big job. Why don't you send out for pizza? The best place in town is Antonio's. I recommend the green chili and pepperoni. Shall I fax them your order now?" The time was 5:15. 40. D'Agosta watched with amusement as two burly workmen unrolled a red carpet between two lines of palm trees in the museum's great rotunda, out through the bronze doors and down the front steps.
"That's gonna get rained on," he thought.
It was dusk, and outside D'Agosta could see big thunderheads piling up to the north and west, rising like mountains above the wind-lashed trees along Riverside Drive. A distant roll of thunder rattled the artifacts in the rotunda's preview case, and a few stray drops began to pelt the frosted glass of the bronze doors. It was going to be a monster storm. The satellite picture on the morning news left no doubt. That fancy red carpet was going to get soaked, and a lot of fancy people along with it. The museum had closed its doors to the public at 5 o'clock. The beautiful people wouldn't be arriving until 7. The press was there already. Television vans with satellite uplinks, photographers talking loudly to each other, equipment everywhere. D'Agusta spoke into his police radio, giving orders. He had close to 2 dozen men stationed strategically around the Hall of the Heavens and in other areas inside and outside the museum. It was lucky, he thought, that he'd finally figured out his way around much of the place. Already, 2 of his men had become lost and had to be radioed back out. D'Agusta wasn't happy. At the 4 o'clock briefing, he had requested a final sweep through the exhibition. Coffey had vetoed it, as well as heavy weapons for the plainclothes and uniformed men inside the party. Might scare the guests, Coffey had said. D'Agusta glanced over toward the 4 walk-through metal detectors equipped with X-ray conveyor belts. Thank God for those, at least, he thought. D'Agusta turned and once again looked around for Pendergast. He hadn't been at the briefing. In fact, D'Agusta hadn't seen him since the meeting with Ippolito that morning. His radio crackled.
Hey, Lieutenant, this is Hanley. I'm here in front of the stuffed elephants, but I can't seem to find the Marine Hall. I thought you said...
D'Agusta cut him short, watching a crew testing what had to be the biggest bank of lights since Gone with the Wind.
Hanley, you see the big doorway with the tusks? Okay, just go through that and take 2 hard rights. Call me when you're in position. Your partner is Wilson.
Wilson? You know I don't like partnering with a woman, sir.
Hanley, there's something else.
What's that?
Wilson's going to be carrying the 12-gauge.
Wait a minute, Lieutenant, you're...
D'Agusta snapped him off. There was a loud grinding sound behind him, and a thick steel door began to descend from the ceiling at the north end of the Great Rotunda. They were starting to seal the perimeter. 2 FBI men stood in the dimness just beyond the doorway, short-barrel shotguns not quite concealed beneath their loose suit jackets. D'Agusta snorted. There was a great hollow boom as the steel plate came to rest on the floor. The sound echoed and re-echoed through the hall. Before the echo faded, the boom was duplicated by the descending door at the south end. Only the east door would be left up, where the red carpet ended.
Christ, thought D'Agusta. I'd hate to see this place in a fire.
He heard a loud voice barking at the far end of the hall and turned to see Coffey pointing his scurrying men in all directions. Coffey spotted him.
Hey, D'Agusta, he shouted, gesturing him over.
D'Agusta ignored him. Now Coffey came swaggering up, his face perspiring. Gizmos and weapons D'Agusta had heard about but never seen were dangling off Coffey's thick service belt.
You deaf, D'Agusta? I want you to send 2 of your men over here for a while and watch this door. Nobody goes in or out. Jesus, thought D'Agusta. There are 5 FBI guys just hanging around in the Great Rotunda picking their noses. My men are tied up, Coffey. Use one of your Rambos over there. I mean, you're deploying most of your men just outside the perimeter. I have to station my forces inside to protect the guests, not to mention the traffic duty outside. The rest of the museum's going to be almost empty, and the party will be under patrol. I don't like that.
Coffey hitched up his belt and glared at D'Agusta.
You know what? I don't give a shit what you don't like. Just do your job and keep a channel open for me.
He strode off. D'Agusta swore. He looked at his watch. 60 minutes and counting. 41. The CRT on the computer went blank, and another message came up. Completed. Do you want to print data, view data, or both? PVB. Margot hit the B key. As the data marched across the screen, Frock wheeled his chair to a stop and brought his face close to the screen, his ragged breath misting the terminal glass. Species. Unidentified. Genus, unidentified. Family, 12% match to Pongidae, 16% match to Hominidae. Order, possibly Primata, 66% common genetic markers lacking, Large standard deviation. Class. 25% match to mammalia, 5% match to reptilia. Phylum. Chordata. Kingdom. Animalia. Morphological characteristics. Highly robust. Brain capacity. 900 to 1250 cc's. Quadrupedal. Extreme posterior anterior dimorphism. Potentially high sexual dimorphism. Weight, male, full grown, 240 to 260 kilograms. Weight, female, full grown, 160 kilograms. Gestation period, 7 to 9 months. Aggressiveness, extreme. Estrous cycle in female, enhanced. Locomotor speed, 60 to 70 kilometers per hour. Epidermal covering, anterior pelt with posterior bony plates. Nocturnal. Frock scanned the list, running his finger down.
Reptilia, he said. There are those gecko genes appearing again. It appears that the creature combines reptile and primate genes, and it has posterior scales. They must also be from the gecko genes.
Margot read down the list of characteristics as they became more and more obscure. Gross enlargement and fusion of metacarpal bones in rear limb. Probable atavistic fusion of forelimb, number 3 and 4 digits. Fusion of proximal and middle phalanx on forelimb. Extreme thickening of calivaria. Probable, 90%, negative rotation of ischium. Extreme thickening and prismatic cross-sectioning in femur. Nasal cavity enlarged. 3. Highly involute conchae. Enlarged olfactory nerves and olfactory region of cerebellum. Probable external mucoid nasal glands. Reduced optic chiasm. Reduced optic nerve. Frock slowly backed himself away from the monitor.
Margot, he said, this describes a killing machine of the highest order. But look how many probables and possibles there are. This is a hypothetical description at best.
Even so, said Margot, it sounds an awful lot like the Mbun figurine in the exhibition.
No doubt. Margot, I particularly want to direct your attention to the brain size.
9 to 1250 cubic centimeters, Margot said, retrieving the printout. That's high, isn't it?
High. It's unbelievable. The upper limit is within human range. This beast, whatever it is, appears to have the strength of a grizzly bear, the speed of a greyhound, and the intelligence of a human being. I say appears, so much of this is conjecture on the part of the program. But look at this cluster of traits.
He stabbed his finger at the list.
Nocturnal, active at night. External mucoid nasal glands. That means it has a wet nose, possessed by animals with a keen scent. Highly involute conchae. Also a trait of animals with enhanced olfactory organs. Reduced optic chiasm. That is the part of the brain that processes eyesight. What we have is a creature with a preternatural sense of smell and a very poor eyesight that hunts nocturnally.
Frock thought for a moment. His brows contracted.
Margot, this frightens me.
If we're right, the whole idea of this creature frightens me, Margot replied. She shuddered at the thought that she'd been working with the fibers herself.
No, I mean this cluster of olfactory traits. If the program's extrapolation is to be believed, the creature lives by smell, hunts by smell, thinks by smell. I've often heard it said that a dog sees an entire landscape of smell, as complex and beautiful as any landscape we see with our eyes. But the olfactory sense is more primitive than sight, and as a result, such animals also have a highly instinctual, primitive reaction to smell. That is what frightens me.
I'm not sure I understand.
In a few minutes, thousands of people will be arriving in the museum. They will be congregating together in an enclosed space. The creature will be smelling the concentrated hormonal scent of all these people. That may very well irritate or even anger it.
A silence settled in the lab. Dr. Frock, Margot said, you said that a couple of days elapsed from the locking up of the crates on the first killing, then another day to the second killing. It's been 3 days since then.
Go on, said Frock.
It just seems to me the creature may be desperate by now. Whatever effect the thalamoid hormones have on the beast must have worn off. After all, those brain hormones are a poor substitute for the plant. If you're right, the creature must be almost like a drug addict unable to get a fix. All the police activity has kept it lying low, but the question is, how long can it wait?
My God, said Frock. It's 7 o'clock. We must warn them. Margot, we must stop this opening. Otherwise, we might as well be ringing the dinner bell.
He moved toward the door, motioning her to follow. He Who Walks on All Fours. Part 3. 42. As 7 o'clock neared, a tangle of cabs and limousines formed outside the museum's west entrance. Elegantly dressed occupants emerged gingerly, the men in near-identical dinner jackets, the women in furs. Umbrellas jousted as the guests rushed up the red carpet toward the museum's awning, trying to avoid the pelting rain that was already turning the sidewalks to streams and the gutters to rushing rivers. Inside, the great rotunda, accustomed to silence at this advanced hour, was resounding with the echoes of 1,000 expensive shoes crossing its marble expanse between the rows of palm trees leading to the Hall of the Heavens. The hall itself held towering stands of bamboo in massive tubs festooned with violet lights. Clusters of drooping orchids had been artfully fixed to the bamboo, recalling tropical hanging gardens. Somewhere deep inside, an invisible band briskly played New York, New York. An army of waiters in white tie threaded their way expertly through the crowd, carrying large silver platters crowded with champagne glasses and ranks of hors d'oeuvres. Streams of incoming guests joined the ranks of museum scientists and staff already grazing on the free food. Spotlights, muted blue, caught the glitter of long sequined evening dresses, strings of diamonds, polished gold cufflinks, and tiaras. Almost overnight, the opening of the Superstition exhibition had become the preferred event among fashionable New York. Coming out balls and fundraising dinners took a back seat to the chance to see firsthand what all the fuss was about. 3,000 invitations had gone out, and 5,000 acceptances had come back. Smithback, wearing an ill-fitting tuxedo with the twin faux pas of wide, spiked lapels and a frilled shirt, peered into the Hall of the Heavens, scanning for familiar faces. At the far end of the hall, a giant platform had been erected. Along one side was the elaborately decorated entrance to the exhibition, currently locked and guarded. A massive dance floor in the center was quickly filling up with couples. Once inside the hall, Smithback immediately found himself surrounded by innumerable conversations, all conducted at a painfully high volume. That new psychohistorian, Grant? Well, she finally fessed up yesterday, told me what she's been working on all this time. Get this. She's trying to prove that the wanderings of Henry IV after the Second Crusade were really just a fugue state brought on by acute stress response. It was all I could do to keep from telling her that...
Came up with the ridiculous idea that the Stabian baths were really just a lot of horse stables. I mean, the man's never even been to Pompeii. He wouldn't know the Villa of the Mysteries from a Pizza Hut, but he's got the gall to call himself a papyrologist.
That new research assistant of mine, you know, the one with the enormous hooters, well, yesterday she was standing by the autoclave, see, and she dropped this test tube full of...
Smithback took a deep breath and made the plunge, cutting a path toward the hors d'oeuvre tables.
This is going to be great, he thought.
Outside the main doors of the great rotunda, D'Agusta saw more rapid-fire flashing from the group of photographers, and yet another VIP came through the door, a wimpy, handsome guy with an emaciated-looking woman clinging to each arm. He stood where he could keep an eye on the metal detectors, the people coming in, and the throngs moving through the single door into the Hall of the Heavens. The floor of the rotunda was slick with rainwater, and the coat check counter was stowing umbrellas briskly. In a far corner, the FBI had set up its forward security station. Coffee wanted a ringside seat from which to monitor the evening's events. D'Agusta had to laugh. They had tried to make it inconspicuous, but the network of electrical, telephone, fiber optic, and ribbon cables snaking out like an octopus from the station made it as easy to ignore as a bad hangover. There was a rumble of thunder. The tops of the trees along the Hudson River promenade, new leaves still budding, were sawing about wildly in the wind. DeGusta's radio hissed.
Lieutenant, we got another argument over the metal detector.
DeGusta could hear a shrill voice in the background.
Surely you know me.
Pull her aside. We gotta keep this crowd moving. If they won't go through, just pull them out of the line. They're holding things up.
As DeGusta holstered his radio, Coffey walked up with the museum's security director in tow.
Report? Coffey asked brusquely.
Everyone's in place, DeGusta said, removing the cigar and examining the soggy end. I've got four plainclothes circulating in the party. Four uniforms patrolling the perimeter with your men. Five controlling traffic outside, and five supervising the metal detectors in the entrance. I got uniformed men inside the hall. Two of them will follow me into the exhibition when the ribbon's cut. I got one man in the computer room, one man in the security control room.
Coffey squinted.
These uniformed men going into the exhibition with the crowd, that wasn't part of the plan. It's nothing formal. I just want us to be at or near the front of the crowd as they go through. You wouldn't let us do a sweep, remember?
Coffey sighed.
You can do your thing, but I don't want a goddamn escort service. Unobtrusive, not blocking the exhibits, okay?
DeGusta nodded. He turned toward Ippolito.
And you?
Well, sir, all my men are in place, too, exactly where you wanted them.
Good. My base of operations will be here in the rotunda during the ceremony. Afterward, I'll deploy. Meanwhile, Ippolito, I want you up front with DeGusta. Get up there near the director and the mayor. You know the routine. DeGusta, I want you to stay in the background. No glory boy shit. Don't fuck up on your last day. Got it?
Waters stood in the cool of the computer room, bathed in neon light, his shoulder aching from the heavy shotgun. This had to be the most boring assignment he'd ever caught. He glanced at the geek. He'd started thinking of him as that, tapping away at the computer. Tapping, tapping, tapping. For hours the guy had been tapping. And drinking Diet Cokes. Waters shook his head. First thing in the morning, maybe he should ask DeGusta for a rotation. He was going crazy in here. The geek scratched the back of his neck and stretched.
Long day, he said to Waters.
Yeah, said Waters.
I'm almost done. You won't believe what this program can do.
You're probably right, said Waters without enthusiasm. He checked his watch. 3 more hours until his relief.
Watch!
The geek hit a button. Waters moved a little closer to the screen. He peered at it. Nothing, just a bunch of writing, gibberish that he supposed was the program. Then the image of a bug appeared on the screen. At first it was still. Then it stretched its green legs and started walking across the lettering on the screen. Then another animated bug appeared on the screen. The two bugs noticed each other and moved closer. They started screwing. Waters looked at the geek.
What is this? He asked.
Just watch, the geek said.
Soon, 4 bugs were born, and they started screwing. Pretty soon the screen was full of bugs. Then the bugs began to eat the letters on the screen. In a couple minutes, all the words on the screen were gone, and there was nothing left but bugs walking around. Then the bugs started eating each other. Soon, nothing was left but blackness.
Pretty cool, eh? The geek said.
Yeah, said Waters. He paused.
What does the program do?
It's just... The geek looked a little confused. It's just a cruel program, that's all. It doesn't do anything.
How long did it take you to write that? Asked Waters.
2 weeks, the geek said proudly, sucking air through his teeth. On my own time, of course.
The geek turned back to his terminal, and the tapping resumed. Waters relaxed, leaning against the wall nearest the computer room door. He could hear the faint sounds of the dance band over his head, the thump of the drums, the low vibration of the basses, the whine of the saxophones. He thought he could even hear the sounds of thousands of footsteps, shuffling and sliding. And here he was, stuck in this psycho ward with nothing but a key-tapping geek for company. The biggest excitement he had was when the geek got up for another Diet Coke. At that moment, he heard a noise from inside the electrical systems room.
You hear that? He asked.
No, said the geek.
There was another long silence. Then a definite thump.
What the hell was that? Said Waters.
I don't know, said the geek. He stopped typing and looked around.
Maybe you ought to go take a look.
Waters ran his hand over the smooth buttstock of his shotgun and eyed the door leading to the electrical room.
Probably nothing. Last time with the gust, it had been nothing.
He should just go in there and check things out. Of course, he could always call for backup from security command. It was just down the hall. His buddy Garcia was supposed to be in there, right? Perspiration broke across his brow. Instinctively, Waters raised an arm to wipe it off. But he made no move toward the electrical room door. 43. As Margot rounded the corner into the great rotunda, she saw a scene of pandemonium. People shaking off drenched umbrellas, chattering in small and large groups, the racket of their conversations adding to the din from the reception beyond. She pushed Frock up to a velvet rope strung beside the metal detectors, a uniformed policeman standing watchfully next to it. Beyond, the hall of the heavens was flooded with yellow light. An enormous chandelier hung from the ceiling, sending flashing rainbows everywhere. They displayed their museum IDs to the policeman, who obediently opened the rope and let them through, checking Margot's carry-all as he did so. As Margot passed by, the cop gave her a funny glance. Then she looked down and understood. She was still dressed in jeans and a sweater.
"Hurry," said Frock. "Up front, to the lectern."
The lectern and podium were on the far end of the hall, near the entrance to the exhibition. The hand-carved doors were chained, and the word Superstition was formed by an arc of crude, bone-like letters across the top. On either side were wooden stelae, resembling huge totem poles or the pillars of a pagan temple. Margot could see Wright, Cuthbert, and the mayor gathered on the platform, talking and joking, while a sound man fiddled with the nearby mics. Behind them stood Ippolito amid a gaggle of administrators and aides, talking into his radio and gesturing furiously at someone out of sight. The noise was deafening.
"Excuse us," bellowed Frock.
Reluctantly, people moved aside.
"Look at all these people," he yelled back at Margot. "The pheromonal level in this room must be astronomical. It will be irresistible to the beast. We've got to stop this right now."
He pointed to one side.
"Look, there's Gregory."
He gestured to Kawakita, standing by the edge of the dance floor, drink in hand. The assistant curator worked his way toward them.
"There you are, Dr. Frock. They've been looking for you. The ceremony's about to start."
Frock reached out and gripped Kawakita's forearm.
"Gregory,"
he shouted,
"you've got to help us. This event has got to be cancelled, and the museum cleared at once."
"What?" said Kawakita. "Is this some kind of joke?"
He looked quizzically at Margot, then back at Frock.
"Greg," said Margot over the commotion, "we've discovered what's been killing people. It's not a human being, it's a creature, a beast. It's nothing we've ever come across before. Your extrapolation program helped us to identify it. It feeds on the packing fibers in the Whittlesea crates. When it can't get those, it needs the human hypothalamus hormones as a substitute. We believe it must have a regular..."
"Oh, hold on, Margot, what are you talking about?"
"Damn it, Gregory," Frock thundered. "We don't have any more time to explain. We've got to get this place cleared now."
Kawakita backed up a step. "Dr. Frock, with all due respect..." Frock clutched his arm harder and spoke slowly and deliberately.
"Gregory, listen to me. There is a terrible creature loose in this museum. It needs to kill, and it will kill. Tonight, we must get everyone out."
Kawakita backed up another step, looking toward the podium.
"I'm sorry," he said over the noise. "I don't know what this is all about, but if you're using my extrapolation program for some kind of joke..."
He prized his arm free of Frock's grasp.
"I really think you should go up to the platform, Dr. Frock. They're waiting for you."
"Greg,"
Margot tried to say, but Kawakita had moved away, looking at them speculatively.
"To the podium," said Frock. "Wright can do it. He can order this place evacuated."
Suddenly they heard a drum roll and a fanfare.
"Winston!"
shouted Frock, rolling into the open space in front of the platform.
"Winston, listen! We've got to evacuate!"
Frock's final words hung in the air as the fanfare faded away.
"There is a deadly beast loose in the museum!" Frock shouted into the silence.
A sudden murmur arose in the crowd. Those closest to Frock backed away, looking at each other and muttering in low tones.
Wright glared at Frock, while Cuthbert quickly separated himself from the group.
"Frock," he hissed, "what in bloody hell are you doing?"
He bounded off the platform and came over.
"What is the matter with you, Frock? Have you gone mad?" he said in a vicious whisper.
Frock reached out.
"Ian, there is a terrible beast loose in the museum. I know we've had our differences, but trust me, please, tell Wright we've got to get these people out, now!"
Cuthbert looked at Frock intently.
"I don't know what you're thinking," the Scotsman said, "or what your game is. Perhaps it's some desperate 11th-hour attempt to derail the exhibition, to turn me into a laughingstock, but I will tell you this, Frock. If you make one more outburst, I will have Mr. Ippolito forcibly remove you from these premises, and I will see to it that you never set foot in here again. Ian, I beg of you."
Cuthbert turned and walked back to the podium. Margot laid a hand on Frock's shoulder. "Don't bother," she said quietly. "They're not going to believe us. I wish George Moriarty were here to help. This is his show. He must be around somewhere, but I haven't seen him."
"What can we do?"
Frock asked, trembling with frustration. The conversations around them resumed as the guests near the podium assumed some kind of joke had taken place.
"I guess we should find Pendergast," Margot said. "He's the only one with enough clout to do something about this."
"He won't believe us either,"
Frock said dispiritedly.
"Maybe not right away," Margot said, wheeling him around. "But he'll hear us out. We've got to hurry."
Behind them, Cuthbert signaled for another drum roll and fanfare. Then he walked over to the podium and held up his hands.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor to introduce to you the director of the New York Museum of Natural History, Winston Wright."
Margot looked around as Wright took the podium, smiling and waving to the crowd.
"Welcome. Welcome, my friends, fellow New Yorkers, citizens of the world. Welcome to the unveiling of the greatest museum show ever mounted."
Wright's amplified words echoed through the hall. A tremendous burst of applause rose to the domed ceiling.
"We'll call security," said Margot. "They'll know where Pendergast is. There's a bank of phones out in the rotunda."
She began to push Frock toward the entrance. Behind her, she could hear Wright's voice booming through the PA system.
"This is a show about our deepest beliefs, our deepest fears, the brightest and the darkest sides of human nature."
44. D'Agosta stood behind the podium, watching Wright's back as he addressed the listening crowd. Then he grabbed his radio.
"Bailey," he said in a low tone, "when they cut that ribbon, I want you and McNitt to get in ahead of the crowd. Just behind Wright and the mayor, but ahead of everyone else. You got that? Blend in as much as possible, but don't let them push you out of the way."
"Roger, Lou."
"When the human mind evolved to understand the workings of the universe, the first question it asked was, what is life? Next, it asked, what is death? We've learned a lot about life, but despite all our technology, we've learned very little about death and what lies beyond."
The crowd was rapt, listening.
"We have sealed the exhibition so that you, our honored guests, will be the first inside. You will see many rare and exquisite artifacts, most on display for the first time ever. You will see images of beauty and ugliness, great good and ultimate evil, symbols of man's struggle to cope with and comprehend the ultimate mystery."
D'Agosta wondered what that business with the old curator in the wheelchair had been. Frock, the name was. He'd shouted something. But then Cuthbert, the honcho of the event, had sent him off. Museum politics. Worse even than down at One Police Plaza.
"Most fervent hope that this exhibition will launch a new era at our museum, an era in which technological innovation and a renaissance in the scientific method will combine to reinvigorate the interest of the museum-going public in today's..."
D'Agosta scanned the room, mentally spot-checking his men. Everyone seemed to be in place. He nodded to the guard at the exhibition entrance, instructing him to remove the chain from the heavy wooden doors. As the speech ended, a roar of applause filled the vast space once again.
Then Cuthbert returned to the podium.
I want to thank a number of people.
DeGusta glanced at his watch, wondering where Pendergast was. If he was in the room, DeGusta would have known it. Pendergast was a guy that stuck out in a crowd. Cuthbert was holding up an enormous pair of scissors, which he handed to the mayor. The mayor grasped one handle and offered the other to Wright, and the two of them walked down the platform steps to a huge ribbon in front of the exhibition entrance.
"What are we waiting for?"
said the mayor facetiously, drawing a laugh. They snipped the ribbon in half to an explosion of flashbulbs, and two of the museum guards slowly pulled open the doors. The band swung into "The Joint is Jumpin'."
"Now," said DeGusta, speaking fast into his radio, "get into position."
As the applause and cheers echoed thunderously, DeGusta walked briskly forward along the wall, then ducked past the doors into the empty exhibition. He did a quick scan inside, then spoke into his radio.
"Claire."
Ippolito came up next, scowling at DeGusta. Arm in arm, the mayor and the director stood in the doorway, posing for the cameras. Then, beaming, they walked forward into the exhibition. As DeGusta moved deeper into the exhibition ahead of the group, the cheering and applause grew fainter. Inside it was cool and smelled of new carpeting and dust, with a faint, unpleasant odor of decay. Wright and Cuthbert were giving the mayor a tour. Behind them, DeGusta could see his two men. Behind them, a vast sea of people, crowding in, craning their necks, gesturing, talking. From DeGusta's perspective within the exhibition, it looked like a tidal wave.
One exit, shit.
He spoke into his radio.
"Walden, I want you to tell those museum guards to slow down the flow. Too many goddamn people are crowding in here."
10-4, Lieutenant.
"This," said Wright, still holding the mayor's arm, "is a very rare sacrificial gurney from Mesoamerica. That's the sun god depicted on the front, guarded by jaguars. The priests would sacrifice the victim on this table, cut out the beating heart, and hold it up to the sun. The blood flowed down these channels and collected here at the bottom."
"Impressive," said the mayor. "I could use one of those up in Albany."
Wright and Cuthbert laughed, the sound reverberating off the still artifacts and display cases. Coffee stood in the forward security station, legs apart, hands on hips, his face expressionless. Most of the guests had arrived, and those who hadn't were probably not going to venture out. It was raining in earnest now, sheets of water cascading onto the pavement. Across the expanse of the rotunda, through the east door, Coffee could clearly see the festivities in the Hall of the Heavens. It was a beautiful room, with coruscating stars covering the velvety black dome that floated 60 feet overhead. Swirling galaxies and nebulae glowed softly along the walls. Wright was speaking at the podium, and the cutting ceremony would be starting soon.
"How's it look?" Coffee asked one of his agents.
"Nothing exciting," the agent said, scanning the security board. "No breaches, no alarms. Perimeter's quiet as a tomb."
"The way I like it," Coffee replied.
He glanced back into the Hall of the Heavens in time to see two guards pulling open the huge doors to the Superstition exhibition. He'd missed the ribbon cutting. The crowd was moving forward now, all 5,000 at once, it seemed.
"What the hell do you think Pendergast is up to?" Coffee said to another of his agents.
He was glad Pendergast was out of his hair for the time being, but he was nervous at the thought of the Southerner wandering around, beholden to no one.
"Haven't seen him," came the response. "Want me to check with Security Command?"
"Nah," Coffee said. "It's nice without him. Nice and peaceful."
DeGusta's radio hissed.
"Walden here. Listen, we need some help. The guards are having a hard time controlling the flow. There's just too many people."
"Where's Spencer? He should be floating around there somewhere. Have him bar the entrance. Let people out but not in, while you and the museum guard set up an orderly line. This crowd has got to be controlled."
"Yes, sir."
The exhibition was filling up quickly now. 20 minutes had gone by, and Wright and the mayor were deep inside the exhibition, near the locked rear exit. They'd moved quickly at first, keeping to the central halls and avoiding the secondary passages. But now, Wright had stopped at a particular exhibit to explain something to the mayor, and people were streaming past them into the exhibition's farthest recesses.
Keep near the front,
DeGusta said to Bailey and McNitt, the two men on advance duty. He skipped ahead and did a quick visual through two side alcoves.
Spooky exhibition, he thought.
A very sophisticated haunted house with all the trimmings. The dim lighting, for instance. Not so dim, though, that you couldn't make out nasty little details, like the Congo power figure, with its bulging eye sockets and torso riddled with sharp nails, or the nearby mummy, vertical in a freestanding case that was streaked with dripped blood.
Now that, thought DeGusta, is a little overdone.
The crowd continued to spread out, and he ducked into the next set of alcoves, all clear.
Walden, how'd you make out?
DeGusta radioed.
Lieutenant, I can't find Spencer. He doesn't seem to be around, and I can't leave the entrance to find him with the crowd the way it is.
Shit. Okay, I'm calling Drogon and Fraser over to help you.
DeGusta radioed one of the two plainclothes units patrolling the party.
Drogon, you copy?
A pause.
Yes, Lieutenant.
I want you and Fraser to back up Walden at the exhibition entrance on the double.
10-4.
He looked around. More mummies, but none with blood all over them. DeGusta stopped, frozen.
Mummies don't bleed.
Slowly, he turned around and started pushing past the eager phalanx of gawkers. It was just some curator's sick little idea, part of the exhibit. But he had to be sure. The case was surrounded by people, as were all the others. DeGusta made his way through the crowd and glanced at the label. Anasazi Burial from Mummy Cave, Canyon del Muerto, Arizona. The streaks of dried blood on the head and chest of the mummy looked like they'd come from above. Trying to remain inconspicuous, he leaned as close to the case as possible and peered up. Above the mummy's head, the top of the case was open, exposing a ceiling crawling with steam pipes and ductwork. A hand, a watch, and the cuff of a blue shirt protruded over the edge of the case. A small icicle of dried blood hung from the middle finger. DeGusta backed into a corner, looked around, and spoke urgently into his radio.
DeGusta calling security command.
This is Garcia, Lieutenant.
Garcia, I've got a dead body in here. We've got to get everybody out. If they see it in panic, we're fucked.
Jesus,
said Garcia.
Get in touch with the guards in Walden. Nobody else is to be allowed into the exhibition. You got that? And I want the Hall of the Heavens cleared in case there's a stampede. Get everyone out, but don't cause any alarm. Now get coffee for me.
Roger.
DeGusta looked around, trying to spot Ippolito. His radio squawked.
Coffee here. What the hell is it, DeGusta?
We got a dead body in here. It's lying on top of a case. I'm the only one who spotted it, but that could change at any moment. We've got to get everyone out while there's still time.
As he opened his mouth to speak again, DeGusta heard, over the noise of the crowd,
That blood looks so real.
There's a hand up there, DeGusta heard someone else say.
Two women were backing away from the case, looking up.
It's a body, one said loudly.
It's not real, the other replied. It's a gimmick for the opening. It has to be.
DeGusta held up his hands, moving up to the case.
Please, everyone!
There was a brief, terrible listening silence.
A body!
Someone else screamed. There was a brief movement of the crowd, followed by a sudden stillness. Then another scream.
He's been murdered!
The crowd peeled back in two directions, and several people stumbled and fell. A large woman in a cocktail dress toppled backward onto DeGusta, slamming him up against the case. The air was slowly forced out of his chest as the weight of more bodies pressed against him. Then he felt the case behind him start to give.
Wait!
He gasped. From the darkness above, something big slid off the top of the case and flopped onto the tight mass of people, knocking several more down. From his awkward angle, DeGusta could only tell that it was bloody and that it had been human. He didn't think it had a head. Utter pandemonium broke out. The close space filled with screaming and shouting, and people started to run, clawing at each other, stumbling. DeGusta felt the case topple. Suddenly, the mummy fell to the floor, with DeGusta on top. As he grabbed the side of the case, he felt glass slice into his palm. He tried to stand, but was knocked back into the case by the surging crowd. He heard the hiss from his radio, found it was still in his right hand, and raised it to his face.
This is Coffee. What the hell is going on, DeGusta?
We've got a panic on our hands, Coffee. You're going to have to evacuate the hall immediately, or... Shit!
He roared as the radio was knocked from his hand by the surging crowd. 45. Margot watched dispiritedly as Frock shouted into an internal phone set in the granite walls of the Great Rotunda. Wright's amplified speech poured out of the hall of the Helens, preventing Margot from hearing a word Frock said. Finally, Frock reached up, slamming the phone onto its cradle. He wheeled himself around to face her.
This is absurd. Apparently Pendergast is in the basement somewhere, or at least he was. He radioed in about an hour ago. They refused to contact him without authorization.
In the basement? Where? Margot asked.
Section 29, they said. Why he's down there, or was down there, they refused to say. My guess is they don't know. Section 29 covers a lot of ground.
He turned to Margot.
Shall we?
Shall we what?
Go down to the basement, of course, Frock replied.
I don't know, Margot said dubiously. Perhaps we should get the authorization they need to summon him up. Frock moved impatiently in his wheelchair.
We don't even know who could give such authorization.
He stared at her, becoming aware of her uncertainty.
I don't think you need worry about the creature confronting us, my dear, he said. If I'm right, it will be drawn to the concentration of people here at the exhibition. It's our obligation to do whatever we can to prevent a catastrophe. We took that on when we made these discoveries.
Still, Margot hesitated. It was one thing for Frock to speak in grandiose terms. He hadn't been inside that exhibition. He hadn't heard the stealthy padding of feet. He hadn't run blindly in the screaming dark. She took a deep breath. You're right, of course, she said. Let's go. Since Section 29 was inside the Cell 2 security perimeter, Margot and Frock had to show their IDs twice on their way to the proper elevator. Apparently, the curfew being suspended for the evening, guards and police officers were more concerned about detaining suspicious or unauthorized characters than restricting the movement of museum employees.
Pendergast!
Frock shouted as Margot wheeled him out of the elevator into the dim basement corridor.
This is Dr. Frock! Can you hear me?
His voice echoed and died. Margot knew a little of the history behind Section 29. When the museum's power plant had been located nearby, the area housed steam pipes, supply tunnels, and the subterranean cubbyholes used by troglodyte workers. After the museum switched to a more modern power plant in the 1920s, the old works had been removed, leaving a series of ghostly warrens now used for storage. Margot wheeled Frock down the low-ceilinged hallways. Every so often, Frock would bang on a door or call Pendergast's name. Each time, his shouts were greeted by silence.
We're getting nowhere,
Frock said as Margot stopped for a breather. Frock's white hair was in disarray, and his tuxedo jacket was rumpled. Margot looked nervously around. She knew approximately where they were. Somewhere at the far end of the confusion of passages lay the vast, silent space of the old powerhouse, a lightless, subterranean pantheon now used to hold the museum's collection of whale bones. Despite Frock's predictions of the creature's behavior, the shouting made her nervous.
This could take hours. He may not be here anymore. Perhaps he never was. Pendergast was our last hope.
Maybe the noise and confusion will frighten the creature, keep it in hiding away from the party, Margot said with a hope she didn't feel. Frock rested his head in his hands.
Not likely. The beast must be driven by smell. It may be intelligent, it may be cunning, but like a human serial killer, when its bloodlust is up, it cannot control itself.
Frock sat up, his eyes filled with renewed vigor.
Pendergast! Where are you?
Waters stood listening, his body tensed. He could feel his heart pounding, and he couldn't seem to gulp enough air into his lungs. He'd been in plenty of dangerous situations.